The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
You know, we really can't predict the future, can we? I mean, you never really know what's going to happen tomorrow. It's like there's a big curtain over tomorrow, and when it lifts, anything's possible. You can't really predict the future. But today, I'm going to prophesy for you. Something that I am going to predict is going to happen in your life. And I can say this unequivocally with the authority of God. And it's this: you will be tempted. You will be tempted. And you're going to come to a point where you think it's too much. This is too much. I can't take it anymore. But along with my prophecy, I'm going to bring you a message from the Bible. It is a message that is incredibly profound and greatly encouraging, and it inspires hope, I believe, and will inspire hope in all of us. And that message is this: God does, and He will provide a way of escape for all of us. And to me, this message is intrinsically tied to the symbolism that we have today as we celebrate the days of unleavened bread. And as we celebrate these days, we contemplate the experience that ancient Israel went through. Here they were, held in the grip of the most powerful nation on the face of the earth at the time. And then God took them out with great miracles, and He freed them from the bondage of the great Pharaoh and of that place that was Egypt, that represents the wicked empire ruled and symbol, that is, ruled by the devil. But God did not free them from temptation, did He? He freed them from sin, that is, Egypt, but didn't free them from temptation, didn't free them from trials. And so the people then traveled to a point where they felt that they were trapped. There they were on the edge of the Red Sea. They couldn't go to the south. They couldn't go to the north. And the sea faced them on the east, and then they could see the army, evidence of the army coming. Because Pharaoh had changed his mind once again. And now he was going after the people, and he was going to destroy them. And you can just imagine Exodus 14 and verse 6. And he made ready his chariots, and he took his people with him, and he took 600 chosen chariots, and all the chariots of Egypt, and the captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And he pursued after the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out with a high hand, but the Egyptians pursued after them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them, encamping by the sea besides Pi-Hahiroth before Baal-Zephon. And when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Man, you read that account, you can almost feel the frightening tension beginning to build in the people. And you know how those pounding horses' hooves, you could probably be felt in the ground. You know, 600 chariots and all those horsemen and everything. That huge army would have risen a cloud of dust that could be seen by Israel. And they'd watch that cloud coming closer and closer and almost taste the sweat and the dust and the smell of blood that was going to come as these people envisioned their families and their wives and their children being destroyed and killed. It seemed so hopeless. It seemed so futile. And massive numbers of the Israelites were affected by this. Many of the people cried out to God for help, but others became distraught, even angry. That's right. And others wished they hadn't followed Moses. They wished that they could have had it to do all over again and they wouldn't have left. They just wanted to give up, knowing that they were going to die. In verse 11 it says this: And they said unto Moses, Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us this way to carry us forth out of Egypt? And isn't this the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, Leave us alone, that we can serve the Egyptians? Or it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians, that we should die in the wilderness. Here they were, faced with the improbable, the impassable, the impossible to them. I mean, put yourself in their shoes. Where would you go? What can you do? And so some wanted to just give up. Then Moses faced these people, fearful and scared, and he said something of enormous importance to you and me today. In verse 13 he says, "And Moses said unto the people, Fear you not, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show you today. For the Egyptians, whom you've seen today, you shall see them again no more forever." And then he says, "The Lord shall fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." And then the Lord said something to Moses. He said this, "Why do you cry unto me? Speak unto the children of Israel that they go forward." It's our message for today. It is the message of these days. The message of Moses, the Lord will fight for you. The message of the Lord, go forward. And this is what we are to learn in the lesson we have today. So Moses lifts his rod and the sea parts in two. Massive walls of water appear standing upright. And it must have been hundreds of feet wide for 2 million people to cross. And it, as we understand it, it must have been 400 or 500 feet high, higher than many of the skyscrapers and high-rise buildings. Can you imagine just walking through it? I mean, it would have been majestic. It would have been awesome. But it would have been very frightening. And in my mind, I picture them as they walk through this path that had been dried for them. I can imagine it, if you've ever been to SeaWorld, where fish would be swimming and they might be able to see the fish swimming right alongside them in the sea through these walls of water. Invisible walls holding up this water from crashing down on him. And then the Egyptians followed them into the sea. In verse 23, the Egyptians pursued and went in after them to the midst of the sea, even all Pharaoh's horses and his chariots and his horsemen. And then this incredible miracle is reversed. The walls are no longer held up. Millions of tons of water came crashing down on the army. In verse 26, it says, "And Moses stretched his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its strength when the morning appeared, and the Egyptians fled against it. And the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea, and the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them, and there remained not so much as one of them. But the children of Israel walked upon the dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. And thus the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore." And the people believed him, didn't they? Imagine that. Tons, perhaps millions of tons of water coming crashing down on those people. They never knew what hit them. They never felt a thing. That water would have hit them. They would have been knocked unconscious immediately and crushed by the tremendous amount of water that was there by these forces. Then the Israelites rejoiced, and they believed Moses, and they believed God. In verse 31, Israel saw the great work which the Lord did upon the Egyptians, and the people feared the Lord, and they believed the Lord, and they believed his servant Moses. 3 days later, they forgot. 3 days later, they complained about the waters. No water. So God gave them water to drink. 3 weeks later, now they complained about something else. They didn't have meat to eat. And so God gave them manna, and he gave them quail. But God kept giving to them, and they kept forgetting, tragically. They forgot that he would provide for them. And after time, they forgot that they could trust him. And when they saw the giants, they feared to go into the promised land. And they forgot the message of this day that they went through, that Red Sea. That's what we celebrate today on the last day. Them going through the Red Sea and being cut off from Egypt and leaving sin totally and completely behind. And they forgot that God would make a way of escape for them so that they could bear whatever it was they had to. They forgot the message of these days. And as Terry Moore pointed out, it's so interesting to me, if you can consider this. Here were all these people sent into Egypt on purpose. And it was prophesied to Abraham, sent in there so that he would bring them out one day, so that they would come into bondage, because it was going to represent a people in latter times, in our time, who would become a people in bondage, that he would pull out. And imagine all these people living their lives. They had their own separate hopes and dreams, just like you and I do. They wanted to get married. They wanted to have children. They wanted to live and have a life and live happily ever after, as it were. And they never knew that they were actors and actresses on a stage, and that this was all being choreographed and it was all being worked out so that a people later would see those lessons and learn from those lessons. So my point today, will we learn from that lesson of the last day of unleavened bread? Will we remember the lesson? Those people were never ever offered salvation. It was just a type for all of us to learn. Will we learn it? So let's go over to 1 Corinthians 10, where Terry Moore was reading. Well, I'm kind of thinking that God must want us, because he read this, he must want us to focus on it today. So we're to learn from their lesson. And here is the lesson in verse 13. There is no temptation, no trial, no temptation taken you, but such is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above what you're able, but will with the temptation also make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. This is the lesson of this day of unleavened bread. The lesson Israel forgot. And the lesson their lives were written in human blood so that we would remember. Will we remember it? The lesson is this. You and I, we've been made free from sin. We have not been made free from temptation and trials. We are going to go through there. And that's why I can prophesy to you this. And in great confidence. James 1. The prophecy is this: you will be tempted. James 1. And there's four facts I want to bring out about temptation. And the first is this: it's common to man. It's common to all of us. Every one of us are going to experience this. It's inevitable. And we've got to bear up under it. And temptation comes, of course, from human nature and Satan and his pulls of this world. But in verse 12 it says, blessed is the man, and I'm going to add, blessed is the woman made from that, and endures temptation. For when he's tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those that love him. That's us. Enduring temptation, isn't it? Overcoming it. The other thing is this: temptation is never brought from God. Let no man say when he's tempted, I'm tempted of God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and neither tempts he any man. And so the other point I want to make is this: it's not a sin to be tempted, is it? No, it's a sin to entertain that temptation and then let it bring forth actions. And that is how we end up with sin. But all of us are tempted, and you may have thoughts come in your mind. You may have wrong thoughts come in your mind, and you will be tempted. But you're not sinning unless you act on those things. But every man is tempted when he's drawn away of his lust, and he's enticed. And then when the lust is conceived, it brings forth sin. And sin, when it's finished, brings forth death. And so it is that when we entertain the temptation, when we ruminate on it, and then when we let it take root, then it will bring forth behavior, and that behavior will lead to sin. So temptation and trials are always going to occur in our lives, and we don't want them. What we want instead is the fast track, the fast pass, they call it in Disneyland. I was reading about this the other day. A man was remarking how in the old days he went to Disneyland and there was this long line. Well, the next time he went to Disneyland, there were two lines. And he's standing in the long line, and people are going in this other line and going right up to the front. And he wondered, well, what's going on? And he found out the magical secret was this. Disneyland now sells a fast pass. They have two lines, and you can buy a pass to bypass the longer short or the longer slow line. Okay, but laugh, but wouldn't you like to have that fast pass when it comes to trials? That's how we are. Trials and temptations, we don't want it. We bristle at trials and problems, and we want to do what? Take the fast pass and go around it. But don't you see this? This is so important to us. Why, going through the temptation, going through the trial, is what is going to earn us the golden character. I mean, if we just had a pure yellow brick road that led to the kingdom, we'd end up all soft and weak, and we wouldn't have overcome anything, and we'd have no reason for Jesus to say, well done, good and faithful servant. And so we want to resist, we want to bristle against this, but it could be that it is what produces the goal. There's a story I read that kind of illustrates this point. It was about a man watching an ant. And the ant was carrying a piece of straw, kind of a large piece of straw. And he was really struggling, and he dragged it up on top of this rock on the way to get to where the anthill was. And he was going to take this piece of straw over to the anthill. So the ant is crawling over this, and there's this big crevice in the rock. The ant is puzzled. It goes to one side, goes to the other side. It can't figure how to get across the crack. But you understand what he did after a while. This ant was smart enough to lay down the straw and push it a little bit and a little bit more until the straw bridged the gap, the crevice in the rock. And then the ant could crawl over the crevice, over the straw, and then he got a hold of it and dragged it over to where he wanted it. But my point to you is this. The burdens we are carrying are not our enemy, you see. They are the bridge to the character that's going to take us into the kingdom of God. And this is why when it happens, as James said, we resist, we bristle, we don't want the trial, we don't want the temptations, we don't want this stuff. But it is something from God's perspective that is reason for rejoicing. It's okay. It's going to work out for our good in the end. And so that's the point today. The ant used his burden as a bridge, and God will provide a means for us to bridge our trials, to get through it all. And if we will do as he says and continue to go forward, what's he going to do? He'll make a way for us to get through it. That's what he'll do. He'll fight our battles for us. It's the lesson Israel forgot. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians 10. 1 Corinthians 10. The lesson Israel forgot is the lesson we must learn. Did they give their lives and we just ignore what they went through? Think how important it was to God. Sometimes you think about how many oxen were ever sacrificed for them to get the point. How many sheep died? Thousands and thousands and thousands to make a point for us, a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. It's amazing the investment that God has made in you and in me. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 1. Probably work better in 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 10, "Moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant how all of our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and they did all eat the same spiritual meat, and they did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." They had a spiritual renewal, didn't they? That's right. They were baptized, weren't they? And they ate of Christ. And they drank of Christ. A type of what we have experienced, isn't it? But God wasn't pleased with them. And is he pleased with his church at all times? He's not very pleased with the church at the end of the age, is he? Because they forgot the lesson that we're going to review today. So 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 5, "But with many of them God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness." So they lusted after these various evil things, the quail, foreign women, and they didn't resist these temptations. They didn't look for a way to escape the temptation for God's way. I want you to think about it for a moment. They had herds of sheep and oxen, didn't they? Well, they could have eaten them, couldn't they? Well, why didn't they eat them? Well, because that was considered their wealth. So they didn't want to give up their wealth, and they're complaining, making God feed them. But you understand my point today. They cared more about their wealth than obeying God. We live in a world today that is all about money, isn't it? It is. It's a system. Capitalism is a system based on greed. And we're taught from the time we're young kids, we've got to have more and more. We've got to have $200 pair of tennis shoes to fit in. So what about us today? We're not lusting after quail, are we? Oh no, we're lusting after cars. We're lusting after big screen televisions, aren't we? We're lusting after our stuff. Many in the church today are lusting after money and what money can buy. And I've watched this change in the last 20 years. They want bigger and better careers today. A lot are going back to school and investing their savings and investing their time in getting prepared for a better career. But so many, I think, in this, not that that's so wrong, but it's where you put your emphasis, because so many today have lost sight of our calling. I mean, our career is to be firstborn. Our career is to become like Jesus Christ, and our career is to make it into that kingdom and to serve as officers, rulers with Jesus Christ in the kingdom, kings and priests. So we've got to resist the spirit that seems to be in the church today, because people are seeking riches in the church, and they are people who are wanting to be rich and wanting to be increased with goods, and they are getting what they want. We're more well-heeled than I've ever seen it before. When I left Ambassador College, before the apostasy hit, kids were coming in to go to college, and they were driving Porsches. Wasn't like that 40 years before that. Things have changed. It's a different world, and money's a big part of it. 1 Corinthians 10. In verse 7, they were committing idolatry. "Neither," it says, "be you idolaters, as were some of them. As it's written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." Yes, they committed idolatry. They created a golden calf, rose up to play before it. That is, they honored the calf with this, with their dance and so on. They honored the calf and not God. Today we think we're so sophisticated. Why, we would never worship a calf. But we worship other things. We worship stuff. And don't we have heroes today that are idols? I mean, they even have a television show, American Idol. Well, we do. We worship our sports heroes, don't we? Yes, we do. Rock stars command massive audiences, and those rock stars, if they tell those young people to do something, they do it. They obey the ones they worship. It's only God's people that don't obey. So they'll dress like them. They'll talk like them. I mean, most of us would never know any of the words of those songs, would we? The kids know them. I don't know how they can tell what they're saying, but they all know all the words to the songs. So we worship, in various religions, crosses, statues of Mary, Saint Christopher, of Jesus. We worship all of this stuff in the religious world. In the secular world, we bow before sex stars, worship our political parties. So much of this is rubbing off on the Church of God in the end times. We've got to resist these temptations, and we've got to overcome them. Okay. Verse 8, chapter 10, Israel caved into fornication. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell in one day 23,000 souls. Today, what isn't driven by money and what money can buy is driven by sex, isn't it? Almost all of the movie channels now have some sort of porn. It may be soft, but it's there, and it's growing, and it's expanding like leaven throughout the media. And right now, I think one of the greatest growing industries is the porn industry. The New York Times had a cover story, and they called it this, The Naked Capitalist. And they said, there's no business like porn business. Its thesis in this was, pornography is big business with $10 billion to $14 billion in annual sales. Frank Rich wrote that pornography is bigger than any of the major league sports, perhaps bigger than Hollywood. Porn is no longer a sideshow to the mainstream. It is the mainstream. And they're all copying it. They're copying it. So you understand my point. We're inundated with sexual temptation today in our society, and it is affecting God's people. And I talk to the singles who are the young men and stuff, and they're struggling with this. It's hitting us big time, and it's a temptation, but it's one we've got to overcome and got to resist. And I say this to anyone out there dealing with it. God will give us a way of escape if we go forward. If we don't stop seeking the kingdom, we continue on putting it first, that God will help us and fight our battles and help us in that fight. By their constant complaining, their lusting, their idolatry, their fornication, and all of this, they, and this is ironic, tempted God. And so it says in verse 9, neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents. And so the Israelites refused to obey him. They complained about the way he cared for them. They didn't really trust God, and they tested his patience, didn't they? They became his trial. And they murmured against Moses and against Aaron and Joshua. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 10. God help us to not try God's patience, but we do at the end of the age, don't we? He loses patience. He no longer knocks, and then he can't be found. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 10 says this, neither murmur you as some of them also murmured and were destroyed of the destroyer. Let's go to Malachi 3 if you would. You can't tell me that this isn't the same spirit that exists in the Church of God today. Very few people. You didn't know any content people in the church? Anybody content with the leadership in the church or what the church decisions are anymore? Because Laodicea means the people who judge. And so all of us around the world are in this spirit, and we're judging everybody else. We know how it should be done. It should be done our way. And so this is what's going on in the church. But it started back when we had the apostasy. And I was there in Pasadena, and I watched this develop where the people murmured against Mr. Armstrong. They murmured against God. I mean, they were just plain, flat out going to go mainstream Protestant, and they were going to overthrow everything. And here was a prophecy of that, Malachi 3 and verse 13, where God says, your words have been stout against me, says the Lord, yet you say, what have we spoken so much against you? And then God says, you've said it's vain to serve God. And what profit is it that we've kept his ordinances and we've walked mournfully before the Lord of hosts? I remember we came out of the apostasy. I remember having a ministerial meeting. I remember one of the ministers there saying, we tithed all these years, and what for? For this? But that's it. This is him right here. And there were dozens and dozens more like him, because what happened? Thousands went home. Thousands went home, didn't they? They complained. They didn't like what they saw. Things didn't go the way they thought they were supposed to go. So they went home. See, the Israelites couldn't go home, could they? They're out in the wilderness. They would have died on their own. But we can go home. We can leave God. We can badmouth him. We can say, well, you didn't bless me the way I expected you to, or things didn't go the way I thought. And we can abandon God. And some have. And some are doing that. Malachi 3 and verse 15. And now we call the proud happy. Yes, they that work wickedness are even set up, and they that tempt God are delivered. I remember when we were over there at Big Bear and looking at the home of one of the architects of the apostasy, and they had a beautiful mansion there on the lake. And they were all well rewarded for the work they did. So people have murmured against God in recent history. They've plotted against him. But others resisted that temptation. Yes, things didn't go the way we thought. We didn't have it go the way we anticipated. But God helped us see the truth, didn't he? And I say this without any equivocation. Do you think that we were smart enough to know the right decision to make when it came to the apostasy? You think it was because we were just smart enough? No. No, of course not. God opened our mind and gave us a gift to know the right direction to go. That is this. He provided a way of escape for us. Didn't he? Yes. And he'll do that if we're honestly seeking him. He will provide a way of escape for all of us. Okay. And we'll be blessed because we took that way of escape. Malachi 3:16. Then they that feared the Lord spoke often one to another, and the Lord hearkened, and he heard it. And a book of remembrance was written for them that feared the Lord and that thought upon his name. Remember how the people at the end don't deny God's name. They patiently keep his word. A book of remembrance is a book that the king had in the ancient times of Persia, in which he would write the names of those individuals who he felt he owed something to. And that was where Mordecai was written, in a book of remembrance. And so God is going to reward those people who have done acts in his name. And it's written in a book. Perhaps we could even say one day a finish to the book of Acts that would include some of the stories of the people who have done acts for God. In verse 17, and they shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spares his own son that serves him. He will make a way of escape, won't he? There is a place of safety. There is a way of escape. And we should pray that we should be accounted worthy to escape all those things. And we will escape them. And so it is that it ends here in 1 Corinthians 10:11. 1 Corinthians 10:11. All these things happen to them for an examples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world have come. Then it says, wherefore, let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. This is a primary problem in the church today. We got a church all around the world that can't be corrected. They think they don't need anything. This is us. This is what it was written for. It was written to warn us. Will we heed the warning? We need to realize we're not much different from Israel. We have the same tendencies, the same temptations in our modern age. All of us are facing temptations and trials of one kind or another. And sometimes they seem really overwhelming, don't they? I mean, I understand this. The pressures can be phenomenal, it seems, sometimes. But I remind us, they're not overwhelming. And we shouldn't think they're overwhelming. Because with God, nothing's impossible. They're not impossible to Him. God will give us a way of escape from those trials and temptations if we'll go His way, led by His Spirit, following His Word and trying to strive to imitate Christ in our lives. When we go forward in faith, He's with us, and He will give us the means to bear our ordeals. You know, you can apply pressure to a stick sometimes, and you can feel it bend, and then you can let off, and it bends, goes back into shape. But I'm sure all of you have done this. You've bent it a little too far, and it begins, the fibers start to break and tear apart. And you can break a stick. I remember when I was in air conditioning, I had never worked with tools very much, and I frustrated my journeyman no end because I would break bolts every day. I didn't have any idea. I didn't have a feel for it. You have to get a feel for it, don't you? And I would pull on the wrench, and the thing would just snap off. And then after a while, I got a feel. You can actually feel as you work in the trade with bolts. You can pull on that. You can feel it's just tension enough where it's going to not go, and then you can stop. You can get a feel for it, okay? Now, the reason I say this is because I want you to understand God lives in you. And He knows the fiber of your being. He's not going to break you. He knows the feel and how much pressure you can take. He knows what we can endure. And He promises He won't give us more than we can bear. And it took me a while, but I got a feel for those bolts. And if I can get a feel for those bolts, I know God knows just how much He can squeeze me. He knows how much we can take. I remember a time, I was zealous. I was trying to do everything right. And suddenly a trial hit me. I lost everything. I mean, I lost every single thing I had in one 24-hour day period. One. I was so shaken, I trembled for 3 days. I just shook. I couldn't, because my faith had been challenged. I thought if I obeyed God, He'd bless me. What was happening? Everything was going wrong. And I just went through a nightmare. And I remember I was working in air conditioning that time, and I went down from the roof to get some parts for my truck, and I just started crying. And I just couldn't take it anymore. And I went in the restroom, and I closed the stall and kind of hid in there, and I said, God, I'm going to break. I cannot take anymore. I'm just going to flat out break. And you know what happened? It was like that whole stall was filled with His Spirit. I'm not kidding. Just warm flood of love. It's like He was just comforting me like I was a little child or something. And I knew it was God. And I thanked Him. And it was all I needed to just keep going. But see, He had the feel. He knew right where I was. And He knew, okay, it's time for comfort. Sometimes it's time for spanking. Sometimes it's time for comfort. But He doesn't stop working with us. And He works with us, giving us a way to bear it. Sometimes it seems unbearable, though, I know that. Let's talk for a minute about Elijah. A man of like passions as you and me, and he had his struggles, and he was stressed out at times. It wasn't smooth sailing for all of God's prophets. We read of Isaiah, we read of Paul, and, you know, he writes these powerful letters, and, oh, yeah, they stoned me and left me for dead, and, you know, and we just read over that, you know. But, boy, that was real. I mean, stuff was happening. I mean, you know, stones hurt, and he may have been dead, and God may have brought him back to life. But you understand, my point is that Elijah went through an awful lot, and here he came to a point where he challenged the prophets of Baal and then built up this altar there and put a bull on the altar, and the prophets of Baal were to call down fire, and they begged and pleaded with their God and so on. Elijah prepares an altar. He tells them, put some water on it. Oh, four barrels ought to do it. Tells them to do it again. Then he tells them to do it a third time. This is 1 Kings 18. Let's go over there. A third time. I mean, this guy is really, he's really on a roll. And he's confident. And he knows what he's doing here. Chapter 18, verse 36, it says this: "And it came to pass at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice." I want to make a brief comment here that you'll notice in your Bibles, if it's King James, that the time of the offering and the evening are in italics. And that means that they're not actually there, because some people will argue that the evening sacrifice was Ben Ha'arba'im, and here it was in the afternoon instead of later in the sunset. But they argue this based on words that aren't actually there. This should read, "And it came to pass at the offering of the sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you're God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I've done all of these words, or at these things at your word. Hear me, O Lord, hear me, that this people may know that you are the Lord God, and that you've turned their heart back again. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice, and the wood, and the stones, and the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces, and they said, The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. And Elijah said unto them, Take the prophets of Baal, let none of them escape. And they took them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishron and slew them there." Here is a moment of enormous triumph for Elijah. Huge success. But then right afterwards, there's a trial that comes. In chapter 19 and verse 1, Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had slain all the prophets with the sword. And then Jezebel sent a messenger unto Elijah and said this: So let the gods do to me and more also, if I make not your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. And so now Elijah runs for his life. Not like he didn't see the sacrifice that just took place at his calling down the fire. He became very depressed, and he went through a period of great depression. In verse 3, "And when he saw that, he arose and went for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree, and he requested for himself that he might die. And he said, It's enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I'm not better than my father's." Boy, there's been times I think I've just wanted to say that. And I know Mr. Armstrong said that a few times himself. Life gets very difficult. So he came to the point where he felt that he wanted to die. And then what happened? God gave him a way of escape. God actually came to him, sent an angel and comforted him. And as he lay and slept under the juniper tree, behold, an angel touched him and said, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was a cake baked on his coals and a cruse of water at his head. And he did eat and drink and laid down again. And so the angel came a second time as well. And my point is that you see, even Elijah with a great success, he felt at this point depression. And he felt like he had lost. He felt like he had failed in accomplishing. But he rose and he ate and drank, it says, went on the strength of that meat 40 days and 40 nights. And so here it is, Elijah should have been on top of the world. He had fulfilled God's mission, but here he was, burdened with depression. You know, it was all in his head though, wasn't it? It wasn't real, because the threats, nobody can touch us, can they? Nobody can touch us without God's approval. It wasn't real. It was something he thought in his head. And we all do this, don't we? We get depressed because of fears. We get depressed because we are afraid. We get depressed for these kinds of reasons, but it's all in our head. It's nothing you can touch. You understand my point? And by this, we sometimes put ourselves in prisons of our own making. There's a story I want to tell about this. It was Houdini. Everybody, I think, knows Houdini. He was a great magician and escape artist. And he was so good, he would make a challenge anywhere he went. He said, you can put me in any jail, and in minutes, I'll get myself out of that jail. I can do it. And so he did. He fulfilled his promise time after time after time, except for one time. They put him in a jail, and he went in his street clothes, and they closed the door. Clank. And there, Houdini pulled out a little piece of metal out of his belt that was hidden. And he began to work the lock. And he worked it, and he worked it. And he couldn't unlock the lock. And an hour went by, and now he's really starting to get nervous, and he's starting to get frustrated. And so he kept working feverishly on this. After 2 hours, Houdini, in frustration, just gave up. And my point, we worry ourselves into prisons of our own making. They aren't real. We just worry about things. Of course, I tell people I have to worry about everything because they say 90% of what you worry about never happens, so I have to keep worrying just to make sure it won't happen. Anyway, when these things happen to us, when you feel the pain, when you feel the fear, when you feel the depression, remember today what this day means. Go forward. God will fight for you. He will provide a way of escape for us. He's promised us, hasn't he? Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. Jesus Christ, the same back there with those Israelites. The same Jesus Christ that opened the Red Sea. He's there today working with you and me. And he says this, I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. I know it feels like he does sometimes because every parent takes their child and tries to get them to learn to walk, and they have them hold two fingers and they let them hold one, then they let go of the one to see if they can walk by themselves. And that's what he does with us. But he's always right there, living inside us. And so it is that we are to go forward with this lesson firmly fixed in our mind. He will provide a way of escape. And so I say to us today, let's resist being caught up and entangled by the pulls of this world, by the fornication that's going on all over the place. Let's flee that. And let's get our stuff, our eyes off of stuff and get it on to the goal. Freedom. Freedom from this world, redeemed one day. 1 Corinthians 15. We made a commitment to follow God's way. Jesus Christ paid the ultimate price so that we could do it. He ransomed us. And you couldn't pay anymore. There isn't enough money in the world to ever even conceive of it to pay what he paid for us. And he made us free from sin. But he didn't make us free from temptations. But this last day of unleavened bread has a lesson embedded within it that is a lesson for you and me. And I say this day, let's recommit ourselves. Brethren, we can do this. With God's help, we can do it. We can keep from getting entangled in the world. We can resist the devil. And if we do, he'll flee from us. And God will not allow us to suffer more than we can bear. He'll make a way of escape. So I say today, as we celebrate this day, stand up. Let's stand up and go forward in faith. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 58. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you found the message beneficial. If you would like to know more about the Eternal Church of God, we would like to hear from you. You may contact us at 1-800-723-7000. 6108. We also invite you to visit our website at eternalcog.org. Once again, thanks for listening.